All right, I'm going to go ahead and get the, or call the House Community and Regional Affairs to order. It is now 8:03 a.m. Thursday, April 20th, 2023 in Capitol Room 124. Members present are Vice Chair McCabe, Representative McKay, Representative Ruffridge, Representative Hemshute, Representative Mears, and myself, Chair Brett McCormick. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Before we begin, I would like to thank Linda Jensen, the House CNRA Secretary from Records, and Jake Wade from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. Today we'll be hearing presentations relating to investing in water and sewer infrastructure in Alaska. It's my intention to spend the first hour hearing from DCCED and DEC, and the second hour hearing from ANTHC and AML. However, if we're able to get done in time, that's completely fine as well. I'm not going to make you use up the whole hour if we don't need to. Nonetheless, we'll Director Sandra Muller from the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, Division of Community and Regional Affairs, please come forward. Put yourself on the record and begin your presentation. And please, other members, if you would introduce yourselves as well, please.
Mr. Chair, Randy Bates, is this okay?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Randy Bates, Director of Water. I'm asking, is it okay if the three of us sit at the table together? We have DEC, represented by Kerry, and myself, and Sandra, Director Muller from Commerce.
Yeah, that's completely fine. Thank you.
Good morning, and thank you very much for allowing us the time to talk about our program with communities. Again, for the record, Sandra Muller. I am the director of the Division of Community and Regional Affairs, and I appreciate the time to share some of the work that we're doing. I did want to highlight three items, three takeaways I'd like you to think about. And that is that DCRA is the only division mentioned in the state constitution, which shows the emphasis of how important communities are to the state of Alaska. Our division and our department believe in the maximum local self-governance, and that best practice scores are a reflection of the community status measured against metrics. So those are the three takeaways. I'd like to... There you go. So we're talking about RUBA, and that's the Rural Utility Business Advisor Program. It is to increase the managerial and financial capacity, and the reason we have DEC here with us is we do a portion of the scoring and working with the communities, and DEC does the remainder of the others. So we also do broader local governance, working with communities, and it's important also to know that we are advisory. The Constitution asks us to collect and publish community information, and that's what we do. If you haven't seen the community database online, I'd be happy, I think, at the end of the presentation, we have a link to that, which has a wealth of community information as well as others. Being advisory only, RUBA works proactively to assist communities, yet relies on communities' engagement and follow-through with RUBA advice and assistance. For instance, having staff available to receive and benefit from RUBA's assistance. Next slide. The RUBA program is funded annually through the US EPA and the Alaska Native Villages Grant. It also funds the remote maintenance worker, which is on the water and sewer side, which DEC administers. Here is the budget that DCRA receives in the grant and how the state matches it. And it staffs several of our local government specialists, also known as LGSs, and that they're not, some of them are funded 100%, some are portions depending. They also pay for travel up to the communities. This slide here shows the unserved and underserved communities, and this is important because this is a priority in the federal legislation, which allows is bringing a lot of funds to Alaska and is going to be a game changer for these communities and looking at what the communities need to get water and sewer into their communities. So it is a high priority. It is also funding two additional local government specialists for DCRA, so we'll have additional staff to support that effort. This slide represents, I'd like to start with the big picture. It is, we have roughly 400 communities in the state, of which 355 are engaged with DCRA on local government issues. And then the green circle shows the 196 communities that are currently in the best practices and participate in that.
Vice Chairman, I apologize. We have a question from Vice Chairman Gabe.
Thanks. Could you go back one slide, please? Could you show me where Talkeetna is on that map?
It is not on there, I believe, sir. Through the chair.
How come?
Mr. Bates, would you like to?
Yeah, for the record, Randy Bates, Director of Water, DEC. Vice Chair McCabe, through the chair, the definition of village within our statutes limits communities to 1,000 individuals or less. Talkeetna, my understanding, has a slightly higher population than that 1,000 limit in the statute.
So that limit, I think, was put in a year after the census, and it was changed a year after the last census. So we're in the process of changing that, as you probably know, to put Talkeetna under there. But it's a shame that we have a village that just happens to be on a road system that doesn't fit a particular definition that has a serious E. coli problem. Serious E. coli problem. They've had water problems for years, and they don't. I think when the last one was done, they were 99 people over that 1,000 definition. They've grown somewhat now. They're another 100 people over, so they're at 1,199 right now by the last population count. So, anyways, sort of editorializing. I apologize.
Representative Hemshute.
Thank you. Through the chair, I appreciate going back a slide. There are no Southeast communities on this map. Is that a different program?
No. No. Through the chair, Representative Hemshute, they also would have to apply to that 1,000 positions.
Okay. Anything else, Carrie?
Yeah, if I may, Carrie Bohan, I'm the Facilities Programs Manager with the Division of Water at DEC. This slide is showing unserved and underserved communities, meaning they don't have piped water and sewer. And so all of our communities in Southeast have piped water and sewer. So they may still be eligible for funding through Village Safe Water. Most are. However, they're just not recognized on this slide because they have full pipe systems.
Follow-up? Please.
Did you say that again?
I said follow-up. No. please continue.
Take a memo, Siri. Donuts tomorrow.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, the Sandra Moeller with DCRA. Slide 6 on the left, this shows the types of programs and assistance we provide to local communities. And each one of these has staff assigned, and we can go through, you know, there's a lot going on in that bubble chart, but it just gives you a sense of the other things that we're helping communities with throughout the state. This slide represents the regional offices of DCRA. We have staff from 1 to 5 individuals in that. We also have 6 or 8 in Anchorage that are local government specialists. We also provide one-on-one small group assistance and 32-hour utility management. We do that either directly in the communities at regional hubs or in Anchorage. During the pandemic, we developed a online version so we can do it virtually, and that has seen some great success. So communities and individuals can decide which method that they would like to have their training. So it's quite the advancement, I think, and it's really been useful. Next slide is is the picture of our Rural Utility Business Advisor Program and the staff that we have. We do have some vacancies that we're currently working on to fill. And again, we'll also have staff for the information, the IJA bill. I can't remember what it stands for. So here's our staff. And we on our CDO, our community development, our community database online also is a way for any community to identify which local government specialist is. This is a picture of our staff in Bethel, Fred Broerman on the right and Sengby on the left, and they work directly with the communities on all sorts of local government issues. The big thing that I wanted to share too is that you see DCRA and DEC here, but we also collaborate with all of these entities. Obviously, not all at once, but there's a big web of what we work with and how we help communities. Sometimes we have to help them with an IRS form or an insurance form. So we reach out and have relationships with these different divisions and associations. Again, our approach to assisting communities is really working with them upon their request for us to work with them. We do not go to communities that do not want us there. If they have a low, we do outreach. We try to work with the utilities on improving their scores, getting certain trainings. And is a financial management training that we had in Anchorage recently, and it's fairly well attended. We do offer a travel stipend for individuals that come in and are able to finish the class. So then we reimburse up to $1,000. We, I believe, are just changing that to $1,500 because of the costs, and that is paid through the grant with the EPA.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair McCormick. I'm trying to go through. There's a lot of slides for today, but I don't see. I see a lot of references to best practices scores, but I don't see necessarily a slide that maybe gives us a reason why that exists, what it is, and how you arrive at that score. I see like a CIP. You have to get a certain score to qualify to have your capital improvement plan recognized or funded or eligible. Do you feel comfortable talking more about the best practices score on this slide, or should that be something later?
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, we do have a slide on page 16 that does go over what the scores look like. If you would like to jump to that, I'd be happy to.
We will wait for that. Thank you.
Again, this is just our travel activity. Both, obviously, during the pandemic, we had a hiatus of travel, primarily from the villages not wanting external staff or people coming in with any, they locked down, essentially. So we've really ramped up our travel to assist communities, and this shows where we've completed travel, where we're attempting to go to, whether weather or other situation prevented us from going, and then a bunch of planned travel as we go. So wanted to share that. We also have the next slide is the training activity where we have the communities either participate virtually in person or in a hub or with their community. So we have good participation across the state on training activities. And so this next slide, number 14, identifies what the role of RUBA is in O&M best practice scores. This is RUBA through DCRA is a component of the total score. It began in 1990. It's had several iterations. And if you think about what DCRA is kind of charted with doing, it's the financial and managerial of the utility. DEC, because they have the engineers and other technical support, they do all the technical, is your operator trained and stuff. So that's that's the difference. However, we do collaborate regularly on both of those as we go. We score twice a year, I believe January and July. And so this is just a slide to show what our role is in that, creating that score. And this is a little more detail. We do it twice a year. Operation maintenance best practice scores are used for many purposes. And I think right here I'd like to just share that we use the best practices, but that's not all we use. We look at whether they're meeting regularly, which is a component of the scoring, but also are they doing elections? Are they handling their personnel? Are they getting their insurance and that kind of thing? So there's a variety of other local government assistance that we provide in addition to sanitation. Because remember back to the slide of 195 in this scoring, and we also have others that are not in the RUBRA program that we assist with elections and other municipal concerns. This slide 16 does show the actual form that was developed, and it is identified. It identifies that this is the technical side, so DEC creates this. They work with the communities throughout the year to increase this. And so we can go through and probably any questions on the specifics of this. We do have a handbook that identifies and helps the local government specialist to determine whether a community gets a 0, a 3, a 5, or a 10. So there's some guidance on that as well.
Vice Chair McCabe.
Thank you. So you said a couple times that we determine, you know, there's a score and we put the score together. Who's we? Is that one person, a committee of people, an office of people? How does that work?
Thank you, through the chair, Representative McCabe. We have assigned local government specialists to each of the communities. So at the scoring time frame, we then task that LGS to score their communities on this scorecard, basically. And once that's done internally at DCRA, we peer review it. So another LGS looks at it and asks questions, and it's a process. And once that's done, we look at all of them from the division and then report those to DEC. I can't speak to their internal process, but that's what we do is fairly robust review of the scores. And like I mentioned, we do have a handbook, and it's really helpful so that we stay consistent, as consistent as we can.
Thank you. So it follow up?
Yeah.
It may be the subject of a different meeting. It's probably too much discussion to have, but I would be interested to know, and we all have a letter from Bethel, I would be interested to know, actually I'd like to see an example of how Bethel was scored and why there's such a huge difference between 2022 and 2023. I expect it will take a while, but it certainly would be great with pictures to show how a local government specialist compares and scores according to the handbook. I think it's important for us to understand why there was a 28-point lower in Bethel between 2022 and 2023. Did something happen? Did they, or was it a change in the government specialist, or a change in the pubs, obviously? So I think that's an important part of our understanding of how that scored. It seems to be a little bit subjective, so... if that's possible, and if it's okay with the chair, if we could maybe have a presentation on that someday, that would be great.
Thank you, through the chair, to Representative McCabe. That is something we can definitely work with you on that. And you're spot on that it varies by community. And we really try to take the subjectivity out of the scoring. And that's where we work with DEC frequently to say, okay, this is where we see it. What do you guys see? And there's a lot of collaboration happening behind the scenes. So I can't speak directly to the Bethel situation at this point, but we'd be happy to look into that. And as you see in the next couple of slides, maybe if I can move on, I can. This next slide is the part that DCRA works on, each of these types of scoring. And we spend the entire year working with communities trying to show where they can put their efforts to help to up their scores so that they can meet what is needed. So we can go into that specifically.
We have some questions for the previous slides. Representative Hemchu, please.
Thank you, Chair McCormick. Through the chair, Director Mueller, I've checked in a few of my communities in Southeast Alaska about the work that they do with you, and they're very pleased with your division, and they feel like they're getting a lot of support. A concern I have on this slide, when you look at a utility, the very top line, utility has more than one operator certified to the level of the water system. I can think of a lot of communities in my region that would not have two people. However, they could collaborate with nearby communities to have those two people. So is it literally a person is living in, two people are living in this community, or can it be that there is access to people who have the technical skills?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Hinchuk. That's a great question. I'm going to ask our colleagues, DEC, since is the technical part. Carrie?
For the record, Carrie Bohan with the Division of Water at DEC. Through the chair, so I'm not certain that we have been asked that question before, but it's an intriguing one. We have an entire program devoted to operator certification, and so we would consider a partnership that was, I think we would need to understand a process to document that it's an actual partnership where we could consider an operator from another community to be a certified operator for, you know, the initial community. The other thing I would point out is that I think we get very set in our ways in speaking about best practices, but I think we chose a title for the operations and maintenance best practices that was meant to be reflective of what we are striving for. And so the top category in each of these different criteria is really meant to be sort of highest bar with zero expectation that most of our communities in rural Alaska are able to achieve that, yet giving them something to see as something to continue to strive for. So that is also why we see our expectations for eligibility in at the 60-point level rather than higher towards 100%. We're not expecting any community is really in a position to hit each of those high bars, yet we want to point out it's still the best practice is to have those levels of achievement.
Follow up.
Thank you for that. Through the chair, I think I would just point out in my region, for example, on Prince of Wales, it's an hour's drive between some of these communities and they could be backup for each other, although I'm sure their water systems would not be identical. And so, but then I can think of places where my family has lived. So Lake and Penn Borough, for example, where people, Lake and Penn is a borough, right? I think so, right. So I think of it as a school district, but, you know, they fly the needed folks around as needed, and so that's not great if the weather's down and the system goes flat. So anyway, I can, I want to hear the rest of the presentation, but I can see the state not just putting money into places where the expertise isn't there. At the same time, there are barriers to the expertise that I'm sure you're well aware of. So thank you for, I'll just keep listening. Thank you.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair McCormick. I had some questions, but first I wanted to go back to something that you had just mentioned a second ago. And I think the exact phrase was, these score sheets may not be something that rural areas are able to achieve. Could you flesh that out a little bit? And I understand that the total scoring is 90 and you have to get sounds like a 60 out of 90. I'm just going through and kind of doing quick math. If you score in the middle-ish area on every single thing on the scorecards, you don't reach a 60. Is that something you can flesh out for me?
Through the chair, so we created a tool that it's actually a total of 100 points that was replacing a previous tool. So prior to 2015, communities that were seeking funding through Village Safe Water might have been selected and awarded project funding, but then they were obligated to work with the RUBA program to demonstrate capacity through what was called the RUBA assessment. It's a tool that I believe still exists but isn't used frequently at this point. And it was, I believe, 27 indicators, and communities had to, it was a yes or no question. Communities had to get a yes on all of those in order to be eligible for funding. And this created a number of problems. First of all, our funding has oftentimes a limited lifespan. And so it could take RUBA working with a community for multiple years to get them to the point that they had achieved success on that assessment. And there, at that point, the funding may have been jeopardized. So in crafting this tool, we had a couple of goals, one of which was to simplify and narrow down on really what we consider the most critical of those criteria, and also to create what we perceived, and I appreciate that may not be the current perception of communities, which is worthy of discussion, a tier in each category to recognize that a community may not be hitting that high bar in, let's say, compliance, but we can appreciate what success they do have and offer a slight increase in points for a slight improvement, and trying to balance that without it becoming overly complicated. And so that's why you'll see some categories have three tiers, if you will, or four. And so I think what we strove for was for that highest point category in every section to be a community with the highest level of capacity that really is just running smoothly and has no difficulties. And again, appreciating that that's not realistic for many of our communities. We set our expectations for eligibility with Village Safe Water at that 60-point level. And how we came to that was looking at each category and with our funding partners thinking, what is the bare minimum, most critical level of capacity that we feel a community must demonstrate to be in a position to take on this project? And so I'm sure I could go on, but I also feel like there might be other questions and I don't want to get too far astray.
Follow up. Okay. And I may talk about this maybe more offline because I have kind of a lot of questions on this section here. But when you mention on this particular slide that you offer certification classes and courses, I have two questions. One, how often are these utilities scored? And then how often is the training offered? Where is it offered, and how much does it cost?
Thank you. Through the chair, Sandra Moeller with DCRA. Thank you for that question. Those scores are handled twice a year. We score them in January and in July, and that's typically about a month-long process of getting the documents and getting the scoring, as I mentioned earlier, with the peer review and actual final scoring. The training is offered throughout the year. It is, I don't have the exact number of how many we train, but probably once a month there is training. We offer a variety of training. One, the most popular one is the financial management one. We also have a QuickBooks training and several others. Local, I don't have that slide right here, but we do offer those throughout, and we also have gone to a hub and worked with regional entities to try to, they would bring in their communities, and we'd do it on request by a hub or a community. We also do send our local government specialists out directly. If one community needs help on getting their budget, we can send somebody out and help them work through that budget. So it's, we also have a contract for a private provider to do QuickBooks. They have a helpline they can call. We get a report of which communities are calling, what their issues are. So we're collecting all that to provide. The cost of the training is zero. There's no cost to attend it. Obviously, a community would have to pay for travel and hotel and per diem type things. We do offer a $1,000 to $1,500 reimbursement stipend for community. They show their receipts and we reimburse them for their costs.
Okay. Vice Chair McCabe.
Thank you. And this might not be the appropriate place, but I wonder how we can, and I don't know this, Alaska Native Villages Grant Program, which is an EPA grant program established by Uncle Ted in 1996. Thank you, Uncle Ted. How does that work with what you all are doing? And I'm also curious if they have the same sort of scoring tool to score different villages, or if they have a different village, because I see a bunch of villages on there that have been, I mean, I hauled the sewer system into Anaktuvik Pass 1 year in a C-130, so I'm interested to know, you know, sort of put those two together and tell me how they relate to each other, how they don't.
Vice Chair McCabe, through the chair, with your permission, my suggestion is let's let Commerce get through their slides. We have a particular slide, and we will definitely deal with your questions within DEC's presentation.
Cool. So. Thanks.
Okay, so moving on to slide 17. This is the section where DCRA is involved. Similarly to the technical, we have a variety of metrics. And as Ms. Bohan mentioned, levels of achievement, a graduation, and to recognize where the community is actually at and working with them. This one other thing I wanted to say, this is an area that continues to be a struggle for many communities. We have seen an uptick in turnover in staff at the local level. Although, you know, we train staff and we used to measure how many trainings and say, okay, this community has been trained, but then we need to look and see that person we trained may have moved on to either another job or to left the community. So we train that community again. So we have continued training needs, and that's what we try to strive for. So this is a reflection of many of the issues that are in rural Alaska. You can see the big headings of the management training. We give points for folks to attend our training, and as well as meeting all of the government body. Are they meeting regularly or taking minutes, et cetera? So you can go down the slide. So this is an area where, again, we work with the communities for their RUBA score. For best practices, the portion, but it also fits in line with what we do with other local government functions. So it's a combined. We focus on meeting these scoring deadlines, which is again July and January. But throughout the year, we're working with communities on a variety of issues, including these. The next couple slides, slide 18, is showing how we collect and report, publish information. Again, the community database online is a reflection of that. You can go on and find any communities. I believe Representative Hemshoot mentioned she's gone on to look at where they're at. Basic information, this site is used by many organizations that work with communities. They want to get basic information, population, who's the mayor, etc. We've created a RUBA hub page, and as you can see, it's a resource where you can find out when the next training is, all kinds of publications. We have a resource desk that we are collecting common, frequently asked questions, issues that come up that we can write down and make it more standard in a response so that a local government or a community can look at this page or ask for it to be emailed to them. So that they can see what the process is. So that is hopefully standardizing many of the activities and the questions that we're getting. This is an area that I've taken very seriously, is reporting out what we're seeing with communities. The next slide is a best practices dashboard that we, so this is a subset of the collection. The slide you're looking at here on page 20 is the overall program. So the boxes with the numbers in it is a average of all communities and all participating RUBA scores. And I put in two other slides, and one is Norvik. And this shows what you can do here is your overall, in this case of Norvik, they have an overall score in the blue box of 60, and it shows what their score is on each of the other categories. What this does is it shows the community or anybody working with them where there's areas that can be improved. And again, this is a snapshot of the previous 6 months. So this gives at least an indication. At the bottom, you can see the historical numbers of what this community has received, and this is the utility. So the RUBA program and the best practices is for water and sewer utilities. So I want to be clear, it's reflective of their efforts in that regard. So this gives a snapshot of where we're at. This also, the next one shows, which is this? Birch Creek. Thank you, Gary. And this gives another example. The green are, green is good, red is not so good. So the red showing zero, and that this is a way that the community can, obviously this community has not been meeting, so they've got zero points on that budget, et cetera. It's similar to what you'd expect. I had another example, but that's something that you can look at and go through and see where each community has been ranked. It also shows the historical. This last slide, I believe, is just the resources that you might want to look at. And I will close with my three opening comments is to remember takeaways is that we are the division that is in the Alaska Constitution. We believe in local, most local self-governance, and that the scoring is a reflection of this utility at this point in time. So with that, I would like to thank you and be available for any questions. And thank you, Chair.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for your presentation. Mm-hmm. Before we get into questions, I just want to make members aware we are kind of running up on that hour. So if we could just kind of keep things tight, I'd appreciate it. So Representative Ruffridge, please go right ahead.
Are you looking at all my scribbles on my okay, so I'm still just a little hung up on the score portion of things, so I just wanted to ask a couple of questions on that scoring sheet. So I just wrote down a few things and I highlighted, so I'm just going to read that quickly. So this would be a score for a community that scored a 47. The primary operator is certified. Utility has a preventative maintenance plan. Utility has under 5 compliance violations, completed utility management training. Their governing body meets routinely and adopted and implemented a budget, has a fee schedule, is compliant with workers' comp, and is up to date with tax obligations. That is a 47 score. It seems to me like maybe this scoring sheet as well is maybe built to prioritize 3 main areas, and that is preventative maintenance, then the budget and revenue. And the other things are sort of ancillary, but if a community is scoring the highest on just those 3 things, they essentially will always be in green. Is that a correct assessment? I'm concerned that people could be trying in this case. And I understand that I think your department and what you're doing is trying to build that compliance, mm-hmm. but sort of that like chicken and the egg conversation of, you know, some of these things are maybe hard to accomplish without some of the pieces that come before. And what is the thoughts of your department on that arena? Is this scoring sheet in need of an update? Are those the 3 things that you really do prioritize and are really trying to drive towards? And what happens if somebody is, like I read, legitimately trying hard, but they're only scoring a 47?
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Ruffridge, that's a great question. We, as we saw on the dashboard, you can see some areas that could be easy wins, or some people would say slow-moving meat, right? You can get those real easily. So that's the first thing we try to do, is look at, you haven't been to a training, send somebody to training, you can get 5 points. Now, that's not the big point, and you're absolutely right. Those are the main areas of preventive and the budget and the revenue. Those are really important things to run a proper utility. But we also look at what are the things that we can get to help them with on slow increments, because adding up those pieces. But absolutely, the concern is when you don't have a budget or any revenue and you can't meet the basics. And it's not like we call up the community and say, hey, do you have a budget? Send it to us. It's a continual effort. How are you doing on your budget? Your budget last year looked like this, and now we need to work on this. Is that still this? How's your collections? What are you seeing? That? So it is, you're absolutely right. It does focus on those. Those are basics. Those are best practices in general. And what we try to do is get that score up as much as we can in identifying what they need. So I hope that answered your questions.
And it just brings me to a follow-up, if I may.
Follow-up.
Karen, this is the last you'll hear from me until the hour is up. Is there like a average cost to the user in rural areas for a utility? Mm-hmm. And how does that compare to, let's say, someone on the road system or someone from Soldotna? Mm-hmm. You know, I pay about $95 to $100 a month for a utility service. What would it be like in an average rural area?
Well, thank you. Through the chair, Senator, Representative Ruffridge, that's also a great question, and I believe my DEC colleagues will be able to help. However, I would like to just mention that when I graduated as a baby engineer, I worked for the Public Health Service, which is now ANTHC. And when we designed and built those water and sewer systems, there was very little effort in looking at costs. We had to check a box that said, you know, did you look at the electricity costs? And as that was many, many years ago. So we've really improved since then. We do business plans and other metrics. So that is a true issue. And that's some of what we look at when we do budgets, is are they setting their rates properly to offset their, you know, looking at what their costs are. And fuel and energy is a big component of that, but there's some variables. So average costs, I believe DEC has put together some costs of what systems would be, and I would guess that it's highly dependent on the energy source and the energy costs. So they can answer if that's the wish.
Mr. Chair, we're happy to either answer that or get into our presentation. I know you have a couple more.
We have a few more questions, but if you'd like to answer that question now, that'd be fine,
or we can.
Again, Carrie Bohan with DEC. Through the chair, I don't know the specific average number off the top of my head, but I certainly can pull that together. But your assumption is correct. The user rates in our rural communities are substantially higher than Juneau. We are, it's, you know, a $35 rate for water. I think we pay, I don't have Juneau sewer. I don't have sewer. So I get, you know, water's $35. It's pretty amazing. We have, for example, one number that I do know off the top of my head. The community of Wales right now, we've just looked at a planning document for piped water and sewer in that community of 142 people. I believe it's 42 homes and a user rate of $300 a month. And it is one of the things that we're most concerned about is, are we setting the communities up for a system that they can't sustain? And what can we be doing in advance to ensure that they're positioned to be successful with that utility so that they can benefit from the public health benefits that it's meant to offer.
And Mr. Chair, Randy Bates for the record, Ms. Bohan stated it, but don't forget fundamentally the capacity assessment and the best practice tool informs both the state and the communities on what it takes and how they need to position themselves and how we need to assist those communities for the safe and sustainable operation of those facilities. And they do cost a significant amount of money, and those user rates are challenging in all communities, in almost all communities. So it's the tools and the scoring system is set up to assist us
in identifying what we need to do as a state to assist the community get to where they can operate these systems. It isn't about a final score at the end of the day. That's not what this is about. This is about setting the communities up for success to know how and what to do to run these systems. We are investing hundreds of millions, billions at this point, into infrastructure in our local communities, and we need to assist them in their success of independently operating and maintaining these systems. And that's what a capacity assessment is designed to do, is give us that information to assist them and give them that information to know how they achieve that, steps to success.
Vice Chair McCabe.
Thanks. And yeah, I'm pretty aware of the cost. I think the sewer system in Anaktuvik Pass that I hauled in was 135 toilets, and it was $750,000 per toilet. So I get that it's a cost, and I'm aware of the maintenance because of the Anderson thing that you and I are dealing with right now. And the, you know, as people moved out, and you mentioned the lack of qualified personnel, and now all of a sudden they're having sewer problems because nobody's really maintaining it. However, I do have a resolution from the city of St. Paul that's about 6 months old, and they talk about the challenges with the scoring. That may be helpful to look at. So inconsistent, lack of clarity about how the score is determined, metrics that seem to vary depending on who is producing a score. Scores are reduced for accrual accounting, even though this is the correct and accurate way to produce financials and reflect government finances best practices. City's financial accounting software is different than QuickBooks. They mentioned turnover. Wastewater operator certificate seems to be based on a national program, not Alaska, which is significantly different than Berkeley, California, or somewhere like that, obviously. So they have a pretty extensive resolution. You know, extra points for two operators in the final score means that communities have to increase rates to maintain skilled operators. Oftentimes, communities like St. Paul have no, you know, industry or no way for people to make money other than through the tribes or, you know, the vagaries of fishing, which we all know is in the toilet right now. So I suggest, or, you know, maybe we just need to look at the scoring and maybe prioritize what you're talking about is operating instead of, you know, certain accounting software or national standards and that sort of stuff. So. Just, I don't know, this is only 6 months old, this resolution, but I think it's significant. It's another Native village that's having struggles. Bethel, St. Paul, Talkeetna's not a Native village, Anderson. I mean, this seems to be a sort of a pervasive problem that I think we need to deal with.
Okay. Representative Hemshoot.
Thank you. Through the chair, I just had a quick question when we were talking about setting their rates. I know that in Sitka we periodically fund a rate study. Is a rate study something you provide, or is the community responsible for setting their own rates? And I assume they also are required to do a study to set their rates. So I can't imagine in a community of 200 people having enough money to fund a rate study. So just looking at the barriers.
Thank you, through the chair. This is Sandra with DCRA. Thank you for the question. We do have a rate setting tool that we provide. It, unlike electric utilities, there isn't a requirement for a rate study. And I think oftentimes we work with communities and the problem is we get it and we do the math and it comes out with something you can't afford. And I think that's one of the concerns as we move forward with these projects in communities that haven't had utility per se, you know, the unserved. They haven't had a pipe, water, and sewer, and of course they're not going to have an operator. And I think what I keep in mind is that we can build all kinds of infrastructure, and it'll only be successful if we have appropriate operating and maintenance of that. And that takes funds. So not sure if that answered, but we do have tools for helping communities set their rates.
All right. I think we'll move on now to the Department of Environmental Conservation. But we'll take a brief at ease to switch over to the other slide deck. briefities. All right, we are now back on the record. We have changed seats and changed slides, and I think we're ready to go.
Thank you, Chair McCormick. Vice Chair McCabe, members of the committee, thank you so much for having us here. My name is Randy Bates. I'm the Director of Water within the Department of Environmental Conservation. We're very pleased, very privileged to be here with you today to talk about this. Thank you for taking this issue up. This is obviously one that needs some time to digest and discuss. I understand the tension around some of these issues, particularly with the scores. So we greatly appreciate both Kerry and I, and I believe Director Mueller, appreciate the opportunity to be here to share with you some information that otherwise isn't always easily available to either yourselves or the members of the public. A couple opening remarks, and I'll cover on a couple things that are not necessarily going to be in Kerry's presentation. I understand we're going to work through this fairly quickly, Mr. Chair, as quickly as we can. We've got some other partners that we feel should be up at the table as well, and we want to give them fair time. So we'll put it on 1.5 mode and get through this. It is very important. Water and sewer infrastructure and the sanitary and safety conditions that it provides is critically important for our rural residents and communities, the foundation of what Village Safe Water is. The current and continued Village Safe Water funding and now the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act funding are providing critical funds to upgrade these water and sewer systems and projects in rural Alaska. And this is very important to know. It's not in the slides. Commissioner Bruni, Commissioner Sandy at Commerce, we are collectively committed, and it is our goal to spend every Village Safe Water and every EJA, if you will, Infrastructure Investment Jobs Act dollar that is appropriate and available to Alaska to build and improve the needed water and sewer infrastructure for our rural communities and to assist them in all ways possible as they endeavor to operate and maintain the facilities safely and for the long term. We are committed to making that happen using both our ongoing funding as well as the landscape changing funding coming with EJA. One of the questions that came up during Director Mueller's presentation was about capacity assessment, and that's been a topic of conversation previously as well as in some letters that have been shared with you and probably part of the presentation that follows next. I'll walk through why we have capacity assessment very quickly and how that capacity assessment has translated to the best practice scoring tool so that we have a firm understanding of why this is in place. EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, has delegated primacy for implementation and enforcement of the Safe Drinking Water Act to DEC. We are a primacy agency, and we have a number of primacy programs like the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, Clean Air Act. RCRA was recently passed. We're pursuing 404, which is the Dredge and Fill Program, as well. With that designation and with the rules that are in place under the Safe Drinking Water Act, that requires that primacy agencies like DEC ensure that all new or modified water systems have the technical, financial, and managerial capacity necessary to comply with the drinking water regulations before they commence operations. So that's a federal law that obligates DEC to ensure that all Village Safe Water infrastructure improvement projects have that adequate technical, managerial, and financial capacity to safely operate the utility in compliance with the laws that are in place. The capacity assessment must occur before DEC issues that approval to construct. That is the way that the laws are set up for us. Our funding agencies, not just ourselves and Commerce, but Kerry will get into some of the other funding agencies that we partner with, which it's a pretty impressive list of the team that came up with this assessment capacity. We developed a criteria to determine that eligibility and priority for the limited resources available. Those limited resources are not, those available resources are not as limited as they once were. There is a massive influx of money through the Infrastructure Investment Jobs Act. So, we're committed to figuring out how to get that money out in the communities and improve their systems. What came out of that, and you heard Director Mueller talk about it, 1990, the capacity assessment went in place. 2015, that best practice scores tool was created by our partners, and it's been in place since that time. It is that operation and maintenance best practice tool that assesses, provides that federal requirement of assessment of the technical, financial, and managerial components for those communities. And it identifies, as I mentioned previously, where we can further assist the communities in their endeavor to safely and sustainably operate that facility. That tool remains a critical component for their ongoing success, both for our assistance as well as the community's knowledge of how to operate this safely. There, for your awareness, we're also in House Finance tomorrow on this very topic, and there's some additional questions there that are relating to best practice scores. One of the questions that we've been asked to address there is, can you get rid of best practice scores in the short term for a year? The answer is no, we can't. By federal law, we cannot just abandon the assessment of capacity. And importantly, as I mentioned, scoring is, and the assessment of that capacity of the community is critically important for us to assist the community and determine how to operate that facility, multi-million-dollar facility, safely for their residents and sustainably for the long term. We want the billions of dollars that's coming to Alaska in this moment to be functional, operational, safe, and provide the sanitary conditions for the residents of those communities for the next 100 years, for not years, but decades, right? And that's what this assessment does in many ways. Those are the end of my comments. I'm happy to. I see you've got a couple of questions, then we'll move quickly.
Representative Hemshute.
Thank you, through the chair. You may or may not know that I'm an educator by profession, and it's rare to find a one-size-fits-all solution for every student in my classroom. And with the best practices model, I almost would reverse it and say someone who is not meeting regularly scores a full five because they need the support to build the capacity to get the systems you're talking about. And so my concern is this, you can't abandon the best practices. Like, I love your dashboard. I think many parts of this are simplified and easy to use. At the same time, is there a barrier to changing how we provide that capacity analysis to a more supportive and perhaps individualized, and I recognize that what I'm talking about would require more personnel, but just saying we have to do it doesn't mean we have to do it in this way, I assume. So you guys are the experts. What else have you looked at?
Sure. Representative Hemshute, through the chair, thank you so much for that question. The dashboard is a step in the process, and it's a meaningful one that gives a picture, a snapshot of what that community's score is. The next steps that we have talked about between Director Mueller, myself, and our two commissioners is identifying specifically what those next steps are for the community to achieve the score necessary. If they have a zero or a two in a particular category, what do they need to do? What does that community need to take on themselves to improve that score? And how can we assist them in that? So it's a two-way street here. The community needs to know the steps to be successful, and we need to know how we can assist them, right? This, as you know, as an educator, you can't educate those. You can't. The student needs to want education. It needs to want to improve as well as the teacher wants to be able to deliver that subject. So let's find a way. We have to identify the tools that makes them aware of the shortcoming in their score and their capacity, and we have to be able to identify how can we get out and help them. Much of this is occurring through Director Mueller's shop, and we've just got different programs. We handle the technical side of things in terms of operation of the facility and what they're currently doing, and then the managerial and financial side is managed through Commerce.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, through the chair. This is way bigger than we can get to today, but you used to be not a division but a department. And there was a change made to make you a division of another department. Has there been a look back? Like I said, I've checked in my communities, and they feel they're getting good support. However, when you changed from a department to a division, was there a loss in personnel? Is there more that we should be doing from the state side to support our communities? And that might be a bigger question that we can get to today. But when we make a big change like that, which was in the Parnell administration, so it's been over a decade, quite a bit over a decade, two decades. Anyway, when we make a big change like that, do we do a look back and analyze what the impacts of that change have been? And maybe that's happened and I'm unaware. So again, this is probably a bigger conversation, but I see communities needing support. I'm always going to fight for local control, but there's a point at which requiring local control and using a hammer to get local control is also saying, you know, the 20-80 principle, 20% of people are doing 80% of the work. And when those 20% are not available or age out or whatever, a community could fall into crisis pretty easily. So I am going off on a bird walk here. I apologize.
Representative Hemshute, through the chair, I'll be very quick in my response, but it may be quicker because it just my thought escaped me. Very quickly, and I may turn this over to Director Mulder, but about 3 years ago, we recognized the declining scores in a couple particular categories. And so we've been working closely with Commerce to identify those scores and figure out a path forward that's going to assist the communities. I think this past fiscal year, Director Mulder was successful in getting some additional funding, increasing travel opportunities, and even additional staff for this particular effort to assist communities in a better way, more frequently, not just for scores, but for local government success. Is that?
And if I may, again, through the chair, this is Sandra Mulder with DCRA, and I think that's a great question to inquire. We do kind of exit surveys at our training, so if we can gather what communities need, direction to staff is always to ask what's best for the community. And it might not be something we can provide, but and they might not be ready for it, but that's always the question at the end of the day. So we'd be happy to explore if there's additional needs. We are working with what we have and really working with the communities that want to work through this program. So thank you for that question.
Okay. Again, Carrie Bohan, the Division of Water at DEC, and I believe we've already covered several of the topics on some of my slides, and so I'll try to move as rapidly as possible. I know Ms. Moreno came from Anchorage. I don't want to deny her opportunity. So the Village Safe Water Program's mission is really just to support sustainable sanitation facilities in our rural communities. We're guided by our state statute, and that's where we find the definition of eligible entities that we've already discussed. We do two major functions. One is we act as a funding agency. We partner with the USDA Rural Development and also the EPA. I believe Vice Chair McCabe mentioned the Alaska Native Villages grant. That is the EPA grant that funds a substantial portion of Village Safe Water. And then we have a similar grant, the Rural Alaska Villages grant from Rural Development. The state partners 25% for each of those. And in recent years, that's been about $80 million. We also have this other critical function, which is we have engineering staff that administer projects on behalf of the communities. And as many of you may know, Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium has a very similar program. We work together. Each community has been assigned to work with one of those agencies. Should they choose to switch and work with the other agency, then we work to accommodate that too. So no community is stuck working with one or the other. There's some opportunity if they're not happy with the efforts that are going on with ANTHC or Village Safe Water, we can address that. But it's really based on sort of historical support. And I appreciate I am going quite quick. It's a talent I have and often gets me in trouble. So please feel free to slow me down if I'm going too quickly. I think we've also noted that historically, and what makes this work so challenging is every need is so compelling. It's important work, it's important need, and every community is fighting for those funds, and administering them requires us to be equitable in doing so, and it's very challenging. You know, certainly if we had all the money in the world, it would be wonderful to be able to meet all of the needs. That's been quite challenging in the past, where annual funding would be in the neighborhood of $100 million, and the total need was well over $3 billion. So each year, the situation was actually becoming worse as, you know, we just weren't gaining fast enough. Under the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, $3.5 billion was allocated to Indian Health Service for American Indian and Alaska Native communities. That's based on data that we and Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium contribute to a national database identifying projects, specific projects. And of that 3.5, 2.1 billion was related to Alaska projects and primarily providing pipe service to the unserved communities. We have had a long-standing partnership. I feel quite lucky to have been able to come into this position and benefit from the structure that my predecessors created with ANTHD, the various federal funding agencies, Denali Commission, RUBA. We meet at least monthly as a group. So we're collaborating to find ways of meeting the needs of all the communities such that none are getting left behind, that we're not stepping on each other's toes or creating conflict. And I would imagine not all states have the luxury of such a great collaboration. I want to touch on an area that often creates confusion, and I'll try to describe it in a way that reduces that confusion instead of exacerbates it. But there are two primary funding allocation processes. One is managed by Village Safe Water, and that's the capital improvement project funding. That's here on the left-hand side. I've put the yellow box around to highlight. And again, this is the funding that I just described for Village Safe Water. And on the right side is the sanitation deficiency system funding allocation. And that's managed by Indian Health Service, but there are other agencies such as Denali Commission and EPA that also contribute funding. So in the allocation process, the same group that I just described a moment ago meets to go through projects and evaluate them for both. So we're continuing to work together as we allocate funding. And then if a community is awarded funding for a project, then the agency that's assigned to support them, Village Safe Water or ANTHD, then takes responsibility for that and administers the project. And so I think oftentimes there can be confusion that if a community is assigned support from ANTHD, that maybe they're only eligible for funding through the Indian Health Service process. This is not the case. You know, they're still eligible for both funding allocation systems. But essentially we kind of pass money back and forth between the agencies, depending on who's supporting the community and where the money's coming from. This is just a visual to show you the substantial increase in funding that I was just describing for, this is last year, you know, Indian Health Service through IIJA, that dollar amount jumped to about $280 million. So it makes all the other bars look like nothing. Let me catch up just 1 second. I believe we've already looked at a slide, again, of the unserved and underserved communities, just pointing out that there are 30 or so unserved communities that don't have piped water, sewer, or wells and septics. These are high-priority projects through the IIJA bill. And then we have a handful of what we consider underserved, meaning, for example, they haul water. And their sewage is hauled out, and they don't appreciate the same health benefits through that system as a fully piped system.
Representative Hemshoop.
Thank you, Chair McCormick. Through the chair, on the previous slide, the asterisk denotes communities that have received funding to bring to fully served status. Does that mean, and the slide before that, 2023 has that, we're in 2023. And so they recently have received that money and they're in progress, or they received it and the project failed?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshute, thank you for that question. These are projects that are actively underway. Many of them, as I look at the list, are in design and not yet initiating construction, but they have been funded for design and construction.
Thank you.
So I think we touched on this earlier, just the enormous expense of capital investments in the communities. Presently, the average cost per home to put a brand new piped water and sewer system is $1 million per home or more. I mentioned Wales earlier, a community of 141 individuals, and I believe it's 41 homes, a school, a clinic, and a couple of commercial buildings. And I believe that the cost estimate for that construction is $47 million. With inflation, I can assure you that's going to be in the mid-50s at least by the time we get to construction. So that has also historically been a challenge because there's simply hasn't been enough money to make those systems come to fruition, although we're now seeing an opportunity to do so. And then, of course, the projects take 5 to 10 years. Village Safe Water is by statute obligated to the best of our ability, make use of local force account work to create an economic benefit for the community and develop a labor force as well. And that can also mean that the project takes longer to develop just because of the capacity of the local labor market to handle the full project.
Representative Hemshute.
Thank you, Chair McCormick. I'll try to be quick. When you talked about $300 a month as an example, is that amortizing the cost of the project, or the project has been completed and the ongoing costs are $300 a month? Is that inclusive of a sinking fund? And what makes that cost so high if the project has been built at no cost and the water's coming in from the river or the wherever? Why is it so high just to operate? And please confirm that includes some kind of sinking fund for maintenance.
Through the chair, Representative Hemshute. So you're correct in that the capital cost of the project is covered through grant funding, but this is annual ongoing operations and maintenance. And so I believe the number for Wales is somewhere around $270,000 a year to pay an operator, to pay for chemicals for treatment, to pay the highest expense in communities, particularly in the north and the west parts of our state, where they're heating and circulating their water continuously. Is the energy costs. And so that's how you know, in a population where you only have 42 homes, it's $300 is the monthly fee once the system is constructed just to pay for the routine operation and maintenance. And oftentimes we hope that there's also some contribution to a repair and replacement account, but most of the communities, this is not taking into consideration full capital replacement costs.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair McCormick. I guess I'm just trying to play catch up here on some of this conversation. So we talk an awful lot right now about piped systems, so like whole utilities. A lot of places in Alaska, you know, I feel like I'm missing something here, so this might be a stupid question. Have a well and septic. What am I missing? Why are we not talking about that? And then I know there's some technology that's being used in some, especially rural areas across the world, with certain types of, different, I guess, non-water-based systems or other options. It just seems that at $1 million per home, potentially there might be some other options that I'm missing. So that would give access for maybe cheaper and faster. I don't know.
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, I think there are portions of our presentation that we're going to have to bypass today, but we do have a section actually where we describe an effort that DEC has undertaken to look at an in-home water reuse system. Wells and septics are also an option. Unfortunately, in all communities, that's not and a possibility when we're talking about the availability of groundwater to drill a well or soil conditions to accept a septic system. And so through our process, and some of this I'll skip through when we get to the slide that it was on, but we work with the communities to develop a planning document that looks at all the different alternatives for how can we accomplish the end goal of providing in-home water and sewer. And so for each community, there may be several different options, and there's an engineering effort to review them and understand why wells and septics aren't the best option in a particular community and that we would go to full piped water and sewer. So we do all of that work in advance of funding a project.
Thank you.
Chair McCormick, in the interest of respect for our partners that want to be at the table in the committee, we recognize there's a lot of interest in this particular issue. Carrie and I are both here in Juneau. We'd be happy to cede our time at the table to our other partners if that's the will of the committee and your wishes. We can work through this process of slides, but we're happy to also come back at your request. So just want to make sure we have all of the information on the table because it's critically important, but we also recognize that there's partners here we want to hear from.
Yeah, I appreciate your consideration of that. I do think that we should probably let our other invited presenters come and speak. They did fly into Juneau, and so I think it's important to hear from them. But I certainly am interested in having you back, maybe dedicating a whole committee time, because this really is a very complex issue, and we have a lot of questions. So, yeah, I really appreciate your consideration of that, and I think it would be good to move on to our next presenter. So thank you. That's okay. Never want to limit discussion. So, we'll take a brief of these. All right, we are now back on the record. At the table now, we are joined by Francine
Moreno,
Director of the Rural Utility Management Services with ANTHC. First, I just want to thank you for your patience. This is obviously a very vast topic, and so we had a lot of questions. We appreciate you waiting and then also coming up to Juneau to provide this presentation. So without further ado, would you please put yourself on the record and go ahead and begin your presentation.
Hi, good morning. For the record, my name is Francine Moreno. I'm the Director of Rural Utility Management Services at ANTHC. I appreciate this opportunity. And on the line, we do have David Beveridge as well, who is our Vice President of Environmental Health and Engineering and Facilities. So thank you for having us. As we all know, the federal government authorized this once-in-a-lifetime $3.5 billion in bipartisan infrastructure law funding for Indian Health Service sanitation needs nationwide. The $3.5 billion need was a snapshot of the cost of deficiencies within the sanitation deficiency system in 2021. $1.9 billion of that $3.5 billion need is just within Alaska. IHS funds are only to serve Native homes, so non-IHS contributions are necessary to pay for the percentage of a project that provides service to other buildings within a community, including the schools, clinics, and non-Native homes. Currently, $173 million is needed for contributions for all projects in the 2021 snapshot of the $1.9 billion need within Alaska. Federal funders provided the contributions needed for FY22 and the plan for FY23, but for FY24 through 25 and 26, contribution need amounts and funding sources are still being determined. So looking at this map, the community shown is the identified IHS sanitation needs in Alaska from SDS's the 2021 project list. Communities are color-coded by piped communities in green, underserved communities with less than 55% of homes connected to the pipe water system is in yellow, and the unserved communities, which are honey bucket communities, are in red. Although the number of underserved and unserved communities are much lower than the number of piped communities, over 75% of the total funding need is for the unserved and underserved communities. In the past, the cost of these projects made them infeasible for IHS funding, but the bill removes that $200,000 per home cost cap as a barrier. In year one, Alaska received $271 million in all sources of IHS funding and $22.5 million in contributions. So again, a total of $173 million in non-IHS contributions will be required to obtain the $1.9 billion in IHS funds. And as of December 22, the need is actually now $2.3 billion. So for today's piped communities captured in the November 2021 snapshot of need, communities in red do not meet the current 60-point best practice funding criteria, which could make them ineligible for the non-IHS funding required. 38% meet the criteria and 62% do not. You'll notice even the large utilities such as Nome, Dillingham, and Utqiagvik, spring 2023 scores do not meet the 60-point funding criteria. For the November 2021 snapshot of need, this map shows communities with existing piped water and sewer and what their affordability burden is based off of the state's affordability framework. Communities in red would not meet the affordability framework if they were seeking funding for the pipe system today. Included on this map are community members of the Alaska Rural Utility Collaborative Program, which I'll talk more about on another slide. And they would also not be considered affordable based off of the framework. Yet each community generates sufficient revenues to pay for expenses, and they all have built sufficient reserves for emergencies.
Representative Ruffridge.
Just a brief question. I was looking at some of the scoring criteria from the previous presentation. I don't see affordability as part of the previous stuff. Where can I find this affordability framework and where the dots have come from for later if I wanted to look into that more?
So the state of Alaska has an affordability framework website that you can go to and look up any community.
Okay, thank you.
Again, looking at the November 2021 snapshot of bill communities, communities in red have scores with less than 60 and or were identified as having a high cost burden for water and sewer utility rates. Thus, if best practice scores in the affordability framework were used years ago when the majority of our water and sewer systems were built, the majority of communities today would not have piped water and sewer. So switching gears a little bit to discuss the health impacts of safe drinking water. Access to safe, clean drinking water is critical for our health and is a basic human health right. This morning, we all woke up and drank coffee, we took showers, we brushed our teeth, and we had clean clothes to wear. For us, we use up to 25 gallons per person per day. In unserved communities, they use maybe 2 or 3 gallons per person per day. So access to safe drinking water ensures we decrease diarrheal illness caused by waterborne microorganisms by 67%. We see 58% less clinic visits from sanitation-related diseases and 55% reduction in overall child mortality.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you. So I assume by piped you mean piped into the house, not just a community well. Thank you.
We all remember hearing wash your hands during the COVID-19 pandemic. Most of us had access to and had the ability to wash our hands using clean water. This was important because it prevented the spread of germs and illnesses. However, some communities were not able to. A collaborative ANTHC CDC study was done comparing rates of water access with water wash diseases. And the outcome was that access to water within a home reduced RSV by 94%, a reduction in pneumonia hospitalizations by 86%, and a 63% reduction in skin and soft tissue infection hospitalizations. An important point to make here is that hospitalizations in rural Alaska doesn't mean you went to the local clinic. It means that you were medevaced out of the community for treatment. And that oftentimes can cost between $50,000 and $100,000. And the impact of water access to our babies. One out of every three babies are hospitalized for lower respiratory infections in Alaska in communities with less than 10% access to water within the home. Our babies are five times more likely to get this infection compared to the United States. And our babies are 11 times more likely to have pneumonia compared to those in the United States. And five times more likely to have an RSV viral infection. The health of our Alaskan population is in our hands. We have an opportunity to partner together to ensure we maximize this once-in-a-lifetime funding opportunity to ensure that all Alaskans have access to health equity. But ANTHC doesn't just work with communities to construct water and sewer systems and then study the critical health improvements as an outcome. Sustainability is important to us and critical to ensuring systems last their lifetime and provides as much health benefits as possible. ANTHC's current sustainability efforts include the Alaska Rural Utility Collaborative, our Rural Energy Program, remote monitoring, and our newest effort, the virtual operator certification training. So ANTHC operates the Alaska Rural Utility Collaborative, or what we call ARUC. You'll hear all throughout that ANTHC likes acronyms. A program that currently partners with 26 communities throughout the state to support community efforts in managing, operating, and maintaining their water and sewer infrastructure. ARUC is a voluntary membership, and member communities choose one representative to attend four quarterly meetings to receive updates and guide the ARUC program's direction and goals, all to operate within the same utility ordinance and have sustainable rates where revenues are sufficient to pay for expenses and build a cash reserve for emergencies. And because we've got 26 communities working together as one, we can utilize bulk purchasing power and economies of scale to keep these costs down. Water and sewer operators have full-time jobs, higher wages, and now receive retirement and PTO benefits. 5.7% of ARUC member communities see operator turnover compared to 75% seen throughout the state. Operators can participate in an exchange program where they travel to other communities to support other communities with emergencies or construction projects. So then they also receive additional support from their fellow operators. The success outcomes of the ARUC program is that 25 out of the 26 member communities have fully funded reserve accounts. And that reserve account on average is over $200,000 per community. They, on average, have a 105% collection rate, which anytime you see anything over 100%, it means that either they've paid their back bills or they've paid their utility bills in advance. The average utility rate within the ARUC program is $135 a month per home. All operators receive in-person or formal operator training, and they have more reliable service. And 85% or 22 of the 26 communities meet best practice score funding criteria. So with this success, AROC is expanding to add an additional 30 member communities. We'll offer this expansion opportunity to unserved communities as priority, and depending on how many slots are left, then other communities throughout the state are more than welcome to join. So rural Alaska communities see high energy costs in fuel and electricity, as mentioned earlier. These costs often make up 40% of a community's operations and maintenance budget. Why this is important and why the Rural Energy Program was established at ANTHC in 2011 was to implement energy reduction projects as an energy efficiency to install LED light bulbs, to provide operator training, to help operators train on cleaning boilers and turn off their heat tape, to install heat recovery systems where they capture heat that is produced from power plants to route to the water and sewer system to heat up either the buildings or heat up the water, to install wind-to-heat projects, solar panels, and micro wind turbines. And so it's through these efforts, communities are seeing ongoing and annual savings of $4.7 million. They've realized $30 million in cumulative savings since installation. 7,745 homes in 86 communities. And the annual energy savings per home is $609. A quick success story for one of our AROC communities who went from being $200,000 in O&M deficit to now maintaining over $500,000 in an emergency parts and reserve account due to energy project implementation, which was heat recovery, energy efficiency training, and wind to heat. And they also saw a monthly residential rate reduction from $165 a month to $85 a month. Remote monitoring of systems is critical. The primary goal is to protect the water and sewer infrastructure. Remote monitoring is a tool that is installed throughout a water plant that allows for remote monitoring of system temperatures, flows, the pump on and pump off timings, heat tape, and it helps communities, regional partners, and those invested in supporting rural Alaska water and sewer. They monitor the system operations through dashboards seen here to receive alerts to issues before they become system-wide expensive emergencies. Remote monitoring also helps identify inefficient energy use as correction prompts to help utilities save money on energy costs. This map indicates the communities who have installed remote monitoring. ANTHC has secured funding from Engineering Ministries International to complete remote monitoring installation throughout the rest of the state, and will fund one position to troubleshoot and ensure all remote monitoring systems are functional and responded to. So today, we have 104 communities that have remote monitoring. 50 more communities will be installed over the next 18 months. And by 2025, all rural off-road communities will have remote monitoring. And lastly, ANTHC's Tribal Water Center began providing virtual operator certification training in 2020. During the 2022 and 2023 training sessions, the Tribal Water Center provided 7 free trainings to 114 students from 42 communities. Students are proctored while taking their relevant State of Alaska certification exams within their community at the conclusion of each course. 68% of the students attending these courses successfully passed their exams, after taking the virtual operator training, that's the silver lining of the pandemic, is being able to virtually provide these kinds of trainings to operators as opposed to having them go to hub communities or here to Anchorage. And since 2020, the program has hosted 273 students and has a pass rate of 78%. These pass rates are critical, as operators having certification to the level of their system is a requirement of the best practice score. Alaska's historical statewide pass rate was 7 to 9%. Courses offered for operators is the small treated system, and so communities that don't have higher treatment requirements, wastewater lagoon training, and the level one operator training. So ANTHC's vision is that Alaska Native people are the healthiest people in the world. Again, we want to thank you for this opportunity to present and to share the update on rural sanitation funding, the health impacts that water access within a home has, and programs that ANTHC operates that focus on sustainability. I'm happy to take any questions anybody might have.
First, I just want to thank you for your presentation, Director Marino. But I'll open the floor now for questions. Representative Hemshute.
Thank you. Thanks for indulging me this morning. So many questions. Through the chair, the remote monitoring, how does that work? Somebody in Anchorage is monitoring systems in remote Alaska, and if something goes wrong, you still have to have the trained person on the ground in the village. Is the goal there to have two people who can respond? And am I understanding the system correctly?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Hemshute. Yes, so the remote monitoring system is a system that anybody can see throughout the state. And so our partners with VSW, community administration can also see the remote monitoring. When remote monitoring is installed, there are alerts that are programmed within the system, and so it sends a text message to whoever needs those alerts. So oftentimes it's the primary or alternate operators that get that text message. If community administration wants to get that same text message as well, they are able to. And then staff within ANTHC also are programmed into getting that text message. So there are various peoples that receive that alert that can then respond to if temperatures are getting too low or water level tanks are dropping, and so we want to make sure that we prevent those expensive disasters.
Thank you.
Follow up. Representative McKay, did you have a question?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure who this should go to, but I definitely want to ask Mr. Bates. These are great presentations. I just see one big area that's not discussed, and that's permitting. My understanding is that every single one of these projects would require a 404 permit for a dig and dredge from the federal government, Army Corps of Engineers. So it looks to me like you have the money, you have the plan, you have everything identified, except you're going to need permits. So I'd also like to know what other permits besides the 404 are required for these projects. Also, for a 404 permit, you need a mitigation, and sometimes that can cost a lot of money just to mitigate. I'm also curious about how you handle permafrost, freeze protection. It looks to me like if you're going to run pipelines to everybody's house, it's going to have to be buried below permafrost level so it doesn't freeze both ways. And I didn't see much of that in these slides. And I'd like to, I guess if we need a 404 permit for every single one of these projects, it seems to me that having 404 primacy within ADEC would be a huge benefit. So I'd like to hear a response to those comments from somebody that knows. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
I appreciate your remarks, Representative McCabe, but I'm not sure that's germane to the presentation at hand, so we can...
It's critical.
Be that as it may, I don't think that's really what we're talking about right now, so I would just say that for another time, unless Director Moreno, you feel Like, you'd like to speak to that?
Through the chair, I would like to address the needing to install water. And so when it comes to permafrost, oftentimes those communities, the systems are built above ground, and so that's where it gets very expensive to keep water flowing when you have to build a system above ground. And also what we found in a lot of water plants that are built on permafrost is as a permafrost melts, the ground thaws, and so it creates shifting within the water plant. And so ANTHC has a patent on a thermosiphon project where you capture the sun is able to refreeze the ground and keep the permafrost frozen so that the shifting of the water plant does not continue. And so as far as that, we are looking at ways to mitigate the impact of climate change on water and sewer infrastructure. And as far as permitting, I don't have an answer for that, unless, David Beveridge, you have an answer. He's on the line.
Through the chair, I do not have an answer for that. This is David Beveridge. Thank you.
So to that question, I'll just say that we'll have Director Bates back another time. We can address that. Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair McCormick. I do want to go back to the affordability conversation. There's a lot of red dots on the map, and I was just looking for the tool online, and I found it, and it's a very interesting and helpful tool, maybe not as updated to the 2023 numbers just yet. So affordability comes back to energy cost, it seems like, in a lot of these instances. What would be some of the solutions that you're aware of to help drive down the cost? And then what happens when all of these systems, and let's say we expand systems with infrastructure dollars, and it's still not affordable. When I don't pay my bill on the road system, things get turned off. I don't think that's happening here. Maybe it is. I don't know. But can you speak to that a little bit? What happens if you can't afford it? Do people still have access to water and sewer?
Through the chair, thank you for that question, Representative Ruffridge. So, for communities within the AERA program, collections is critical. And so homes will get shut off if for non-payment. But what we are doing when you're looking at the operational expense of a water and sewer system, as I was mentioning, with the rural energy program, what we found is that 40% of the operational budget is in energy. When you're looking at all the other expense costs for water and sewer, you can't decrease operator labor. You need operators to operate your system. You can't decrease the equipment material that you need to keep the systems operating. But what you can do is decrease the cost of energy because it is 40% of the overall expenses. And so that's why we've implemented the Rural Energy Program to install renewables to reduce the cost of diesel fuel and electricity within the water and sewer system. And so because of the installation of rural energy projects, we're able to make the water and sewer system rates more affordable.
Just a follow-up to that idea of energy. So, you know, we have long ongoing conversations about a pipeline for natural gas, and we have a whole, you know, many millions of dollars and years of time invested into that. And I've always found it interesting that pipeline seems to leave out Western Alaska in a large part. Is that something that ANTHC or you're aware of, is, you know, thoughts about it, either putting a pipeline to Western Alaska using natural gas or importing natural gas if we liquefied it at some point? Would that help drive down energy costs? And is that a conversation that's ongoing?
Through the chair, thank you for that question, Representative Ruffridge. I don't have the answer to that. But any ways that we can reduce the cost of energy in rural Alaska is absolutely something that we would look into.
Thank you.
Are there any more questions for Director Marino? Thank you very much for your presentation this morning and providing your expertise, and also just for illustrating, I think, some of the critical issues that we have to live with in rural Alaska. I really appreciate that, and looking forward for any opportunity that we have to continue to work with you. So thank you very much for donating your time and coming to the Capitol. So.
Thanks for inviting me. It's real springtime here. And I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Next, we have Nils Andresen with the Alaska Municipal League. Should we take a brief at ease or no? Okay. Mr. Andresen, if you have some remarks, please go right ahead. But I do understand we have some folks to speak on this as well. So.
Yeah, thank you. For the record, Nils Andresen, I'm the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League, and really glad to be here with you today. I know we're running up on time. I'd actually defer to the folks on the phone to maybe if they could just say a few words, and then I can try to wrap up in a minute and a half at the end. We'll see how that works.
Okay. And I'm more than happy to go a little bit over time. I think this is critical, and so if that needs to happen, we can totally do that. So, but first, we'll hear from Phil Zavadil from St. Paul. You'd state your name for the record and go ahead and provide your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Phil Zavadil, the city manager for the city of St. Paul, Alaska. I'd just like to thank you for the opportunity to speak on the topic today. The staff at DC and DCRA know that I've been vocal about this program for years, and I appreciate the work DC, DCRA, and NHTC has provided to our communities and in specific to St. Paul. That said, I would like to see some major reform of this program or perhaps elimination of this program. Many of our rural communities have major water sewer needs that have been talked about today that include St. Paul Island. I would propose changing how we do business and take advantage of the money that we do have now through the infrastructure dollars. Just a brief thought is like creating a strike team of engineers and construction contractors to quickly evaluate the need, develop plans, construction drawings, and then prioritize and address the water sewer needs in our communities and then fast track construction. In my view, the best practice scoring program has been a punitive program and has not been extremely valuable to the city of St. Paul. Many of our communities that have the greatest needs are never going to score well. St. Paul, in particular, our scoring has been inconsistent and varied over the years, and we have not really done anything different other than try to meet the needs of to get a higher score, which doesn't translate into significantly improving how we manage our utilities. So I think we can do better. We must do better for the health and safety of our citizens, of our state, of our rural communities, of our Alaska Native communities. And just like to thank you again for taking this opportunity to discuss this. And it's an important topic for all of our communities.
Mrs. Zavadil, thank you very much for calling in. I think if you would be willing to, we'll just have you stay on the line if once we hear from our other caller, if anyone has any questions. So, but thank you for calling in and expressing your viewpoint on this situation. Next, we have City Manager Pete Williams. Before you provide your testimony, Pete, I just want to congratulate you on your upcoming retirement. And just want to thank you for your service for the City of Bethel. It was an honor and a privilege to be able to work with you in my time on the City Council. So, Senator Williams, if you go ahead and state your name for the record and go ahead and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members. My name is Peter Williams. I'm the city manager for the City of Bethel. About the last 7 years, my staff and I have worked with RUBA to try to satisfy the requirements on scoring, their scoring criteria. And You know, I think one of the biggest frustrations on our part is, I guess it'd be, I'd call it communication. We understand the score sheet, or at least we think we do, and we provide the information that we think would pertain to what they're asking. It's, you know, early on, it was mentioned that, the scores are, in January and then another round of scoring in July. My question has always been is, we don't receive the score, you know, 4 months after they're scored, we receive our score, and it is what it is. But if there's a discrepancy, I've always wondered why, when they aren't scoring, why they don't just give us a call on and say, hey, you need this or you need that. Even though the deadline's passed, I understand that, but almost everything that they've nicked us for could be resolved with a simple email. It'd take 2 seconds. And he's 2 minutes away, the compliance officer. So, and a lot of times it's just a misunderstanding. I mean, I fill out, I work with leases, I work with whatever have you all day long. And sometimes, you know, a piece of information is missing. There's an email exchange. Everybody's happy and moves down the road. But just to seem to cut somebody off because there's a deadline and it's done. It just doesn't seem quite right. And I, as far as one frustration it's a mystery to me, kind of, is the budget, the financials that we have to submit. You know, we have a bunch of, we have elected officials here, the city council. They're on council two, maybe 3-4 years sometimes, you know, and I put 27 pages, or so I guess it's 17 pages of financial statements in front of them. It's all Greek. So to have them approve it, it just doesn't seem pertinent. I mean, I could put any piece of paper in front of somebody and say, can you approve it? And they'll probably say yes. But it just doesn't seem, I mean, to expect them to understand the fund balance. I've got 15 budgets in my water and sewer fund. It just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. It seems like maybe the finance director would vet it, or maybe even the city manager. But that's been a source of, and then, you know, this last time around, we've got our budgets online. I don't know why we have to submit it, but, I mean, they could open it up and see our budget. Everybody can see our budget. The last go around was, there seemed to be a discrepancy, but not the budget itself, but the ordinance that was put out with the budget. And it was all new to us. So I just think, as far as the scoring goes for these, you know, some back and forth, a little back and forth would resolve a lot. And just to say, hey, on the deadline's December 31st. If you don't have the right stuff turned in by January 1st, you're done. Just doesn't quite know. And if you got a real low score, maybe you can't come up with all that information. But, you know, where we went from a 87 to a 49, and we thought we submitted the same information as the time before, you know, just an email while you were scoring that instead of a letter saying you're done, would have resolved it. I guess that's kind of what I have to say. You know, the funding has really been frustrating for us, just so committee members may understand, is we recently put out a project that was estimated at $13 million pre-COVID, and the bids came back at $48 million. So some of these funding opportunities where they're asking for, you know, they say, well, you know, we got a funding opportunity and it's a grant loan. The loan payments are, we just can't afford them. I mean, you know, our utility just doesn't have the revenue to afford the loan payment. So we don't qualify, for, the project. So the loans are, you know, to use a loan, I just don't think we'll see a whole lot of projects completed by using the grant loan process, or even the state. I mean, I understand the interest rates are low, but they still put the projects out of reach because of the cost of the what we're seeing the cost of the projects are just astronomical. And even though we have millions and millions of dollars that were secured at the federal level, I'm really concerned about how far those dollars are going to really go in the end. And I guess that's all I've got to say for now. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Manager Williams. Are there any questions for Mr. or Manager Zavadil or Mr. Manager Williams? No? Director Andreessen, do you have any closing remarks?
Yeah, thank you. For the record, again, Nils Andreessen, Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League. I'm struck by this map. The red dots on this map are communities where the state has determined, either through affordability criteria or best practice scores, that it will not invest in the water and sewer systems that these communities need. And it seems to me that these can't be nails in a coffin. They have got to be considered cries for help, and they have to be differently approached in how we think about sustainability. I think for this committee, many good questions that have been asked, and I understand that you'll come back to this and revisit it, and the DEC didn't have a chance to go through its slides. I think there's good, broad questions. What does federal law require? And if it's sustainability, how much leeway does the state have in determining exactly what that looks like? When it comes to sustainability, I don't think of sustainable communities as what they can do alone. I think of sustainability as what we can do together. And a score that determines an isolated community and what they can bear or manage alone is not the same as what they can do in partnership with DCRA, with DEC and the Circuit Rider Program, with ANTHC and AML. And I know that those partners can take these red dots and turn them green with a coordinated, consolidated approach that includes resources, that includes having capacity building and other types of investments that help to address maintenance and operations, help to address governance and financials, help to rework best practice scores to make sure that they're responsive to the needs of and conditions of communities. Representative Ruffridge, you mentioned a base score of 47.5. If that was the base score, 37 more communities would not have a red dot based just on best practice scores. I think rethinking how we approach best practices, who decides affordability, and is it the community or is it the state? I think those are valid questions. AML members did pass a resolution last December that articulates a path forward for changes to the best practice program, and I can provide that to the committee. But more than anything else at this point, I mean, I would offer that we knew this was out there as an issue last year. We knew federal funding and investment was coming, and yet we're still at the same point as we were last year, looking at lots of red dots who won't benefit from that federal funding. Now is the time for us to commit, not just in words, but in actions, to real change. And that means addressing each of these criteria and figuring out paths forward where we're working together, municipalities, the Alaska Municipal League, ANTHC, and its amazing AIRC and other programs, the incredible staff at DEC, and the obligations that they have in statute to this program, and the incredible staff, the local government specialists at DCRA, who are contributing to supporting our communities and improving these measures. I know that we can do this together, but it really does take a consolidated and very intentional effort to see the difference that we want to on this map. Thank you.
Vice Chair McCabe.
So thank you, Mr. Andreessen. I would urge you, that slide is awesome, but it's missing a few communities. Those are largely native villages off the road system, but we're missing Sutton Alpine, Buffalo Soapstone, Talkeetna, Funny River, Toke, Prudhoe Bay. All these are communities that fall just a little bit outside that 1,000 person population limit that are suffering from the same sorts of things, even though they are on the road system. in largely not native communities, they're suffering from the same thing. So I think an all-inclusive approach, maybe through AML, would probably be a better solution, hopefully would be a better solution for some of those folks as well. So I appreciate it.
Would you like this?
Just Vice Chair McCabe, I think if we keep our eye on the ball, we want to improve the public health and living conditions of Alaskans, bottom line. And drawing a line in the sand based on population or scores makes that very difficult.
Amen.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair McCormick, and thank you for being here, Mr. Andreessen. Obviously, you have a connection to a large number of villages, cities, municipalities around the state. Alaska's big, a lot of different problems, issues. Is there a model for what this looks like in Alaska or rural Alaska? Is there a place that's doing it well, or is that going to look different everywhere you go?
Yeah, Representative Ruffridge, through the chair, I think there's a common practice of looking at healthy babies. And the green dots are healthy babies, right? Something that they're doing is brought them above and into a best practice score that makes them eligible. I talked to Sam Chinar, the city manager out in city of Tuxuk Bay, who has a score of 100. And he said, you know, 5 years ago when he came into the job, DCRA worked one-on-one with him to address their some of the debts that they had. And that was a huge hurdle that it took a lot of intensive time to overcome. And since then, it's kind of like you teach to the test, I think would be the district, the school district. He is taught to the test. He turns in his forms and is very cognizant of following the guidelines and having the support from DCRA to do so. So we look at those kinds of things. We look at ARUC and the amazing progress that, you know, those communities have seen. Their expansion could make a huge difference in this. What would that look like across the state? What are the support systems that they've put in place that have made a difference in those communities? Could AML do something similar for those that we serve? I think there are models. I think we build on where there are green dots and what they're doing right, and we look elsewhere for what can partners bring to the table to support and augment the work that the good work that DEC and DCRA are doing.
Thank you.
Representative Hemshue.
Thank you, Chair McCormick. Through the chair, Mr. Andreessen, if we overlaid population on these dots, is there any kind of correlation? Red dots, small population, green dots, bigger?
Representative Hemshue, I am not the best, through the chair, not the best to speak to it. Seems like it would affect the affordability criteria maybe a little, but I would have to come back to you on that.
Yeah. Well,
Representative Hemshue?
It's really just a comment I have that I'd be curious about that question, but it's affordability, but also capacity of the community. And I'm just, I've already stated, I really like empowering local communities to make their own decisions and to make their own way. But it's like you said, at some point, it's, I don't know what you said, I can't remember what you said, something about nail in the coffin. And maybe we should be looking at what we can do to help outside of the rubric that's been provided that I think is a great rubric. But again, on that rubric, you score 10 if you're meeting. And I would rather have you score 10 if you're not meeting and use those high scores to place the state's assistance. And the question, if there is one, I guess, to you is, at what point are we overstepping as a state in assisting communities? Just shoveling money their way isn't necessarily the answer. So how does one determine, how does the state determine where to help and how to help?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Hemshue. I mean, what money wouldn't be a bad thing. Community assistance has been decreased, reduced by 50% during the same time that best practices scores on average were reduced by 5 to 10. I don't think those things are unconnected. and community assistance has been decreased. It would be 984% more if it were at the levels that it was at in 1985 or something like that. So funding is part of the answer to the question of population. I mean, staff turnover, council turnover, who's the mayor and who's the manager, how much experience, the training that Director Moeller talked about. I mean, you can have training necessary every 6 months in some communities where there's really a limited population. But I think more directly to your question, that's where partners come in. Where there's limited capacity, money's not going to make the difference always, but partners might. Partners can augment capacity. They can be capacity. They can help check the boxes if that's what's needed for best practices to make sure that when we look at sustainability is a community effort. And the 10 points that they receive for need is met by resources from the outside to complement what's at the local level.
Any more questions? But Representative McKay.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure that the letter from the Department of Environmental Conservation dated April 7th, addressed to Representatives Edgman, Foster, McCormick, and Puckatuck, and signed by Commissioner Jason Bruni, is in our record for this meeting. And in particular, point out the last paragraph of that letter, which discusses 404 permitting for these projects. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions or comments? All right. Well, thank you very much, Director Andresen, for speaking. And to the city managers, Peter Williams and Phil Zavadil as well. Thank you to Director Moeller, Director Bates, and Manager Bohan for your presentation. We'll certainly invite you back. I apologize for cutting you off so soon, but we really do appreciate you allowing ANTHC to provide their presentation. So thank you, Director Marino, as well, and Mr. Beveridge for being online. Next week, our regular scheduled time will be our next meeting on Tuesday and Thursday. Information on what those topics will be about will be forthcoming. We'll have that for you by the end of the day. The time is 10:13 a.m., and this hearing of the House Community and Regional Affairs is now adjourned.